The whole clan was edgy, and Brunn hardly had one good night's rest from the time he made the decision to hunt Mammoth, and sometimes wished he had never thought of it. Brunn called a meeting of the men to discuss who would go and who would stay behind. Protecting the home cave was the important issue. "I have been considering leaving one of the hunters behind," the leader began. "We will be gone at least a whole moon, perhaps as much as two. That is a long time to leave the cave unprotected." The hunters avoided looking at Brunn. None of them wanted to be excluded from the hunt. Each one was afraid if the leader caught his eye, he might be the one selected to remain behind.
"Brunn, you will need all your hunters," Zaug motioned. "My legs may not be fast enough to hunt Mammoth, but my arm is still strong enough to wield a spear. The sling is not the only weapon I can use. Dorv's sight is failing, but his muscles are not weak, and he's not blind yet. He can still use a club or a spear, at least well enough to protect the cave. As long as we keep the fire going, no animal is going to come too close. You don't need to worry about the cave. We can protect it. You will have enough to worry about hunting Mammoth. The decision is not mine, of course, but I think you should take all the hunters."
"I agree, Brunn," Dorv added, leaning forward and squinting a little. "Zaug and I can protect the cave while you are gone." Brunn looked from Zaug to Dorv and back to Zaug. He didn't want to leave any of his hunters behind. He didn't want to do anything that might jeopardize his chances for success.
"You're right, Zaug," Brunn finally gestured. "Just because you and Dorv can't hunt Mammoth doesn't mean you are not strong enough to protect the cave. The clan is fortunate you are both still so able, and I am fortunate that the second in command to the leader before me is still with us to give me the benefit of his wisdom, Zaug."
It never hurt to let the old man know he was appreciated. The rest of the hunters relaxed. None of them would be left behind. They felt sorry for the old men who could not share in the great hunt, but grateful it was they who would be left to guard the cave. It was understood that Mogur would not make the trek either. He was no hunter. But Brunn had, on occasion, seen the old cripple brandish his stout walking stick with some force in self-protection, and mentally added the magician to the cave protectors. Certainly the three of them could do as well as a single hunter.
"Now, which of the women will we take with us?" Brunn asked. "Abra will come."
"Uka too," Grad added. "She is strong and experienced and has no small children."
"Yes, Uka is a good choice," Brunn approved. "And Ovra," he said, looking at Guv.
The acolyte nodded in agreement.
"What about Oga?" Proud asked.
"Brock is walking now, and he'll soon reach his weaning year. He doesn't take much of her time."
Brunn thought a moment. "I don't see why not. The other women can help watch him, and Oga is a good worker. We can use her."
Proud looked pleased. He liked to know his mate was well thought of by the leader. It was a compliment to his good training.
"Some women must stay to watch the children," Brunn motioned. "What about Aga and Ika?
Grub and Igra are still young to travel so far."
"Abba and Isa could watch them," Krug volunteered. "Igra is not much trouble for Ika."
Most men liked to have their own mates along on an extended hunt. Then they didn't have to depend on another man's mate to serve them.
"I don't know about Ika," Drug commented, "but I think Aga would rather stay this time. Three of the children are hers, and even if she takes Grub, I know Ona would miss her. Vorn would like to come with us, though."
"I think both Aga and Ika should stay," Brunn decided. "And Vorn, too. There will be nothing for him to do. He's not old enough to hunt, and he wouldn't be very eager to help the women, especially without his mother to keep after him. There will be other mammoth hunts for him."
Mogur hadn't volunteered any comment up till then, but felt the time was right.
"Isa is too weak to go, and she needs to stay and take care of Uba. But there's no reason Ayla can't go."
"She's not even a woman," Proud interjected, "and besides, the spirits might not like it if the strange one is with us."
"She's bigger than a woman, and as strong," Drug contended. "A hard worker, good with her hands, and the spirits favor her. What about the cave? And Ona? I think she will bring luck."
"Drug is right. She's a fast worker, and as strong as a woman. She doesn't have any children to worry about, and she's had some training as a medicine woman. That could be useful. Though if Isa were stronger, I'd rather take her."
"Ayla comes with us,"
Brunn gestured with finality. Ayla was so excited when she found out she was going along on the mammoth hunt, she couldn't sit still. She pestered Isa with questions of what to take with her, and had her basket packed and repacked several times in the final days before they planned to leave.
You don't want to take too much, Ayla. Your load is going to be much heavier on the way back if the hunt is successful. But I do have something for you that I think you should take. I just finished making it. Tears of happiness came to Ayla's eyes as she saw the pouch Issa held out. It was made from the whole skin of an otter, cured with the fur, head, tail, and feet left intact. Issa had asked Zaug to get one for her, and she had kept it hidden at Drug's hearth, including Aga and Abba, in on her surprise.
Issa, my own medicine bag, Ayla cried, and hugged the woman.
She immediately sat down and removed all the small pouches and packets, setting them out in rows as she had seen Issa do so many times. She opened each one and sniffed at the contents, then tied them all back up with exactly the same knots with which they had been tied originally. It was difficult to distinguish between many dried herbs and roots by smell alone, though particularly dangerous ones were often mixed with an innocuous but strong-smelling herb to prevent accidental misuse. The real system of classification was the type of cord or thong that held the pouches closed, and an intricate combination of knots. Certain classes of herbal remedies were tied with cord made of horsehair, others with the hair of bison or some other animal whose hair had a distinctive color and texture. Still others were tied with sinew, or the cords made of stringy barks or vines, and some with leather thongs. Part of memorizing the uses of a particular plant was knowing the type of cord and the system of knots used to close the pouch or packet that held it. Ayla put the pouches back into her medicine bag, then tied it to the cord at her waist, admiring it. She took it off and put it near her collecting basket, along with the large bags that would be used to hold the mammoth meat they hoped to bring back. Everything was ready. The only problem that gave Ayla any cause for concern was what to do with her sling. She would have no use for it, but she was afraid to leave it behind for Issa or Kreb to find. She thought of hiding it in the woods, but thought some animal might dig it up, or the exposure might ruin it. Finally, she decided to take it with her, but keep it well hidden in a fold of her wrap. It was still dark when the clan got up on the day of the hunter's departure, and the multi-hued leaves were just starting to show their true colors as the sky lightened when they started out. But as they passed beyond the ridge east of the cave, the radiant gleam of the rising sun broached the horizon, illuminating the broad plain of standing hay below with an intense golden glow. They trooped down the wooded flanks of the foothills and reached the steps while the sun was still low. Brunn set a fast pace, nearly as rapid as when the men went out alone. The women's burdens were light, but unused to the rigors of rapid travel, they had to push to keep up. They traveled from sunup to sundown, covering a much greater distance in a day than when the entire clan was looking for a new cave. They did no cooking except to boil water for tea, and little was required of the women. No game was hunted along the way. They all ate the traveling food the men usually took hunting, dried meat ground to a coarse meal, mixed with clean rendered fat and dried fruit, formed into small cakes. The highly concentrated traveling food supplied their nutritional needs more than adequately. It was cold on the open windy prairie and got colder rapidly as they traveled north. Even so, shortly after they started out in the mornings, they removed layers of their clothing. Their pace warmed them quickly, and only when they stopped for short rests did they notice the frigid temperature. The aching muscles of the first few days, especially the women's, soon disappeared as they hit a stride and developed traveling legs. The terrain of the northern part of the peninsula was rougher. Broad, flat plateaus suddenly disappeared into steep ravines or abutted sheer cliffs, the result of rumbling upheavals in the violent earth of earlier times, shaking free the constraints of limestone bonds. Narrow canyons were walled with jagged rocky faces, some dead-ending where the walls conjoined, and some strewn with the rubble of sharp-edged fallen boulders cleaved from the surrounding bulwarks. Others channeled occasional waterways, ranging from small seasonal streams to rushing rivers. Only near watercourses did a few wind-twisted pines, larches, and firs, crowded by birches and willows, stunted to little more than brush, relieve the monotony of the grassy steppes. In rare instances where a ravine opened into a watered valley, sheltered from the incessant driving wind and supplied with sufficient moisture, the coniferous and small-leafed deciduous trees more closely approached their true proportions. The journey was uneventful. They traveled at the steady, fast pace for 10 days before Brunn began sending out men to scout the surrounding area,
slowing their progress for the next few days. They were close to the broad neck of the peninsula. If they were going to find Mammoth, they should begin to see them soon. The hunting party had stopped at a small river. Brunn had sent Braud and Guv out earlier in the afternoon, and he was a short distance off from the rest, looking in the direction they had gone. He would have to make a decision soon whether they would camp beside this river or continue farther before they stopped for the night. The late afternoon shadows were lengthening into evening, and if the two young men did not return soon, the decision would be made for him. He squinted his eyes as he faced directly into the sharp east wind that whipped his long fur wrap around his legs and flattened his bushy beard against his face. Far in the distance, he thought he saw movement, and as he waited, the running figures of two men became more distinct. He felt a sudden twinge of excitement. Perhaps it was intuition, or perhaps it was his sensitive attunement to the way their bodies moved. They saw the solitary figure and put on a fresh burst of speed, waving their arms. Brunn knew long before their voices could be heard. "Mammoth! Mammoth!" the men shouted, out of breath as they raced toward the group. Everyone crowded around the exultant men. "A large herd to the east!" Braud gestured excitedly. "How far?" Brunn asked. Guv pointed straight up, then moved his arm down in a short arc. "A few hours," the signal indicated. "Show the way," Brunn motioned, and signaled the rest to follow. There were still enough hours of daylight left to move closer to the herd. The sun was crowding the horizon before the hunting party saw the dark blur of movement in the distance. "It is a large herd," Brunn thought as he called a halt. They would have to make do with the water they carried from the previous stop. It was too dark to look for a stream. In the morning, they could find a better campsite. The important thing was that they had found Mammoth. Now it was up to the hunters. After the troop moved to a new encampment beside a meandering creek defined by a double row of scraggly brush along each bank, Brunn took his hunters to reconnoiter the possibilities. A mammoth could not be run down like a bison or tripped with bolas. A different tactic had to be devised to hunt the woolly pachyderms. Brunn and his men scouted the ravines and canyons in the vicinity. He was looking for a particular formation, a blind canyon that narrowed to a close defile with boulders lining the sides and piled up at the closed end, not too far from the slowly moving herd. Early in the morning of the second day, Oga nervously sat down in front of Brunn, head bowed, while Ovra and Ayla waited anxiously behind her.
"What do you want, Oga?" Brunn motioned as he tapped her shoulder.
"This woman would make a request," she began hesitantly.
"Yes?"
"This woman has never seen a mammoth. Neither have Ovra or Ayla. Would the leader allow us to go closer so we can get a better look?"
"What about Abra and Uka? Do they want to see a mammoth too?"
"They say they will see enough mammoth before we are through to satisfy them. They have no wish to go," Oga replied.
"They are wise women, but then they have seen mammoth before. We are downwind. It should not disturb the herd if you do not go too close and do not try to circle around."
"We will not go too close," Oga promised.
"No, I think when you see them, you will not want to go too close." "Yes, you may go," he decided.
It won't hurt to let the young women make a small excursion, he thought. They have little to do now, and they will be busy enough later, if the spirits favor us. The three were excited about their proposed adventure. It was Ayla who finally convinced Oga to ask, though they had all talked about it. The hunting trip had thrown them into a closer association than they normally had at the cave, and it gave them an opportunity to get to know each other better. Ovra, who was quiet and reserved by nature, had always considered Ayla one of the children and did not seek her out for companionship. Oga did not encourage too much social contact, knowing how Braud felt about her, and neither of the young women felt they had much in common with the girl. They were mated women, adults, mistresses of their men's hearths. Ayla was still a child who did not have the same responsibilities. It was only that summer, when Ayla assumed a quasi-adult status and began going on hunting trips, that the women began to think of her as more than a child, and especially during the trek to hunt for mammoth. Ayla was taller than any of the women, which gave her the appearance of an adult, and she was treated in most ways as though she were a woman by the hunters. Krug and Drug, in particular, called upon her. Their mates were back at the cave, and Ayla was unmated. They didn't have to make their requests through another man or with his permission, however informally it was asked or granted. With the common interest of the hunt, a friendlier relationship developed among the three younger females. Ayla's closest associations before were with Issa, Kreb, and Uba, and she enjoyed the newfound warmth of friendship with the women. Shortly after the men left in the morning, Oga left Brak with Abra and Uka, and the three started out. It was a pleasant hike. They soon fell into animated conversation with rapidly moving hands and emphatic words. As they drew closer to the animals, their conversation fell off and soon ceased altogether. They stopped and gawked at the massive creatures. The woolly mammoths were well adapted to the harsh periglacial climate of their cold environment. Their thick hides were covered with an undercoat of dense, soft fur and an overlayer of shaggy, long, reddish-brown hair up to 20 inches in length. They were further insulated by a 3-inch layer of subcutaneous fat. The cold had caused modifications in their body structure, too. They were compact for their species, averaging 10 feet high at the withers. Their massive heads, large in proportion to their overall height and more than half the length of their trunks, rose high above their shoulders in a peaked dome. They had small ears, short tails, and relatively short trunks, with 2 fingers at the end, an upper and a lower one. In profile, they had a deep depression at the nape of the neck between their domed heads and a high hump of stored fat on the withers. Their backs sloped down sharply to the pelvis and somewhat shorter hind legs. But most impressive were their long, curved tusks. "Look at that one," Oga gestured and pointed to an old bull. His ivory tusks originated close together, pointed steeply downward, curved sharply outward, upward, then inward, crossing over in front of him and continuing on for a full 16 feet. The mammoth was tearing out swaths of grass, herbs, and sedge with his trunk and stuffing the tough, dry fodder into his mouth to break it down with efficient rasp-like grinders. A younger animal, one whose tusks were not so long and still useful, uprooted a larch and began to strip it of twigs and bark. "They're so big," Ovra motioned with a shudder. "I didn't think any animal could be so big. How are they ever going to kill one? They can't even reach one with a spear." "I don't know," Oga said, just as apprehensive. "I almost wish we hadn't come," Ovra said. "It will be a dangerous hunt. Someone could get hurt. What will I do if something happens to Guv?" "Brun must have a plan," Ayla said. "I don't think he'd even try to hunt them if he didn't think the men could. Wish I could watch," she added wistfully. "I don't," Oga said. "I don't want to be anywhere near. I'll just be glad when it's over." Oga remembered her mother's mate had been killed in a hunting accident just before the earthquake that took her mother. She was well aware of the dangers in spite of the best of plans. "I think we should go back now," Ovra said. "Brun didn't want us to get too close. This is closer than I want to be." The three of them turned to go. Ayla looked back a few times as they hurried away. They were more quiet on the return trip, each lost in her own thoughts and not in the mood for much talk. When the men returned, Brun directed the women to break camp and move after the hunters left the next morning.
This is the end of disc number 8. Please insert disc number 9. This is disc number 9.
When the men returned, Brun directed the women to break camp and move after the hunters left the next morning. He had found a suitable location. They would hunt tomorrow, and he wanted the women well out of the way. He had seen the canyon early the day before. It was an ideal site, but too far from the mammoths. He considered it a particularly good omen that the herd, moving slowly in a southwesterly direction, had wandered close enough by the end of the second day to make the site feasible. A light, dry, powdery snow, whipped up by gusting east winds, greeted the hunting party as they unrolled from their warm furs and poked their noses out of low tents. The dismal gray sky, hiding the glowing sun that lighted the planet, could not dampen the keen anticipation. On this day, they would hunt mammoth. The women scurried to make tea. Like athletes finely tuned for the game, the hunters would take nothing else. They stamped around, making practice lunges into the air with their spears to stretch and loosen taut muscles. The tension they projected charged the air with excitement. Grad took a glowing coal from the fire and put it in the auroch's horn attached to his waist. Guv took another. they wrapped furs securely around themselves. Not the usual heavy outer wraps, but lighter garments that would not restrict them. None of them felt the cold. They were too keyed up. Brunn went over the plan quickly, one last time. Each man closed his eyes and clutched his amulet, picked up an unlit torch they had made the evening before, and set out. Ayla watched them go, wishing she dared to follow them. Then she joined the women who had begun to collect dried grass, dung, brush, and wood for fires before they broke camp. The men reached the herd quickly. The mammoths had already begun to move again after resting for the night. The hunters squatted down in the tall grass to wait while Brunn appraised the animals that moved past. He saw the old bull with the massive curving tusks. What a prize he would be, he said to himself, but rejected the beast. They had a long distance to travel back to the cave, and the huge tusks would weigh them down unnecessarily. The tusks of a younger animal would be easier to carry, and the meat more tender besides. That was more important than the glory of displaying massive tusks. Younger bulls were more dangerous, though. Their shorter tusks were not only useful for uprooting trees, they were very effective weapons. Brunn waited patiently. He had not made all the preparations and the long trip in order to rush now. He knew the circumstances he was looking for, and would rather return the next day than risk their chance for success. The rest of the hunters waited too, not all of them as patiently. The rising sun had warmed the dull, overcast sky and scattered the clouds. The snow stopped, and bright rays broke through open spaces. When is he going to give the signal? Proud motioned silently to Goove. Look how high the sun is already. Why start out early and just sit here? What is he waiting for? Rad caught Proud's gestures. Brunn is waiting for the right time. Would you rather go back empty-handed or wait a while? Be patient, Proud, and learn. Someday it will be you who must decide when the time is right. Brunn is a good leader, a good hunter. You are fortunate to have him to teach you. It takes more than bravery to be a leader. Proud wasn't too pleased with Grodd's lecture. He will not be my second in command when I am leader, he thought. He's getting too old anyway. The young man shifted his position, shivered a little from a strong gust of wind, and settled down to wait. The sun was high in the sky when Brunn finally gave a get-ready signal. Every hunter felt a sharp stab of excitement. A female, heavy with young, was near the periphery of the herd and edging farther out. She was fairly young, but by the length of her tusks, the pregnancy was probably not her first. She was far enough along in it to make her ponderous. She wouldn't be as fast or agile, and fetal meat would be a succulent bonus. The mammoth spied a stand of grass not yet encountered by the rest and moved toward it. For a moment, she stood alone, a solitary animal away from the protection of the herd. It was the moment Brunn was waiting for. He gave the signal. Rad had the hot coal out and a torch held in readiness. The moment Brunn signaled, he held the torch to the ember and blew until it caught and leaped into flames. Droog lit two others from the first and gave one to Brunn. The three younger hunters had dashed toward the canyon the moment they saw the signal. Their part would come later. As soon as the torches were lit, Brunn and Grad ran behind the mammoth and laid the fiery brands to the dry grass of the prairie. Full-grown mammoths had no natural enemies. Only the very young and very old ever fell prey to any predator, except man. But they feared fire. Prairie fires from natural causes sometimes raged unchecked for days, destroying everything in their path. A man-caused fire was no less devastating. The moment they sensed danger, the herd instinctively closed in. The fire had to take hold quickly to prevent the female from rejoining the rest, and Brunn and Grad were between the she-mammoth and the herd. They could be charged from either direction or caught in a stampede of behemoths. The scent of smoke turned the peacefully grazing animals into a bedlam of trumpeting confusion. The female turned toward the herd, but it was too late. A wall of fire separated her. She sirened for help, but the flames, fanned by the brisk east wind, had converged on the milling animals. They were already stampeding to the west, trying to outdistance the fast encroaching blaze. The prairie fire was out of control, but that was of little concern to the men. The wind would carry the destruction away from the place they wanted to go. The she-mammoth, screaming her fright, lurched in panic toward the east. Droog waited until he saw the flames take hold, then raced away. When he saw the mammoth begin her charge, he ran toward the confused and frightened beast, shouting and waving his torch, veering her to the southeast.
Krug, Braud, and Goove, the youngest and fastest of the hunters, were pelting away at top speed in front of her. They were afraid the frantic mammoth would outpace them even with their head start. Brunn, Grad, and Drug raced behind her, trying to keep up and hoping she wouldn't alter her course. But once started, the behemoth charged blindly straight ahead. The three young hunters reached the Box Canyon, and Krug turned into it. Braud and Goove stopped at the south wall. Nervous and out of breath, Goove reached for the aurochs horn, sending an unspoken plea to his totem that the coal had not died. It was live, but neither of them had much breath to blow flame to the torch. The brisk wind provided an assist. They both lit two torches, holding one in each hand, and moved out from the wall, trying to anticipate where the mammoth would approach. The wait was not long. With a silent prayer to their totems as the frightened, trumpeting, gigantic animal stampeded toward them, the brave young men raced into the face of the charging mammoth, waving smoky torches in front of them. They had the difficult and dangerous job of turning the petrified animal into the canyon. The panic-stricken pachyderm, already running in fear from the fire and confronted with the smell of smoke ahead, looked for an escape. She swerved and pounded into the canyon with Braud and Goove right behind her. The bellowing behemoth plowed through the canyon, reached the narrow defile, and found her way blocked. Unable to move ahead or to turn in the tight space, she screamed her frustration. Braud and Goove sprinted up breathlessly. Braud had a knife in his hand, one carefully shaped by Drug and charmed by Mogur. In a swift, reckless dash, Braud ran for her left hind leg and with the sharp blade slashed her tendons. Her strident cry of pain split the air. She could not move forward, she could not turn sideward, and now she could not move backward. Gu followed Braud and hamstrung her right foot. The great beast fell to her knees. Then Krug jumped up from behind the boulder in front of the faltering mammoth, trumpeting in agony, and plunged his long, pointed spear straight into her open mouth. Instinctively, she tried to attack and spewed blood over the weaponless man. But he was not weaponless for long. Other spears had been stashed behind the rocks. As Krug reached for another spear, Brunn, Grad, and Drug reached the canyon and raced to the blind end, leaping up on the rocks at either side of the huge, pregnant mammoth. They lunged their spears into the wounded creature almost simultaneously. Brunn's penetrated one small eye, spurting him with warm scarlet. The animal lurched. With her last burst of life, the mammoth trumpeted a defiant scream and slumped to the ground. Realization came slowly to the exhausted men. In the sudden silence, the hunters looked at each other. Their hearts beat faster, with a new kind of excitement. A formless, primal urge from deep within rose and exploded from their mouths in a cry of victory. They did it. They killed the mighty mammoth. Six men, pitifully weak by comparison, using skill and intelligence and cooperation and daring, had killed the gigantic creature no other predator could. No matter how fast or how strong or how cunning, no four-legged hunter could match their feet. Braud leaped up on the rock beside Brunn, then jumped onto the fallen animal. In a moment, Brunn was beside him, clapped him warmly on the shoulder, then pulled his spear from the mammoth's eye and held it aloft. The other four quickly joined them, and moving to the rhythm of their own heartbeats, they jumped and danced their elation on the back of the massive beast. Then Brunn leaped down and circled the mammoth, nearly filling the narrow space. Not one man was wounded, he thought. Not one man has so much as a scratch. This was a very lucky hunt. Our totems must be pleased with us. We must let the spirits know we are grateful, he announced to the men. When we return, Mogur will hold a very special ceremony. For now, we will take the liver. Each man will have his piece, and we will bring back a piece for Zaug and Dorv and Mogur. The rest will be given to the spirit of the mammoth. It is what Mogur told me to do. We will bury it here where she fell, and the liver of the young mammoth inside her, too. And Mogur said we are not to touch the brain. That must be left where it is for the spirit to keep. Who struck the first blow, Braud or Goove? Braud did, Goove responded. Then Braud will get the first piece of liver, but the kill is credited to all. Braud and Goove were sent to bring the women. In one burst of energy, the men's job was completed. Now it was up to the women. To them fell the tedious task of butchering and preserving. The men remaining behind eviscerated the huge mammoth while they waited for them and removed the nearly full-term fetus.
After the women arrived, the men helped them skin the animal. It was so large, it took the effort of all. Selected favorite parts were cut out and stored in stone caches to freeze. Fires were built around the rest, partly to keep it from freezing, and partly to keep away the inevitable scavengers drawn to the smell of blood and raw meat. The tired but happy hunting party sank gratefully into their beds of warm furs after their first meal of fresh meat since leaving the cave. In the morning, while the men gathered together to relive the exciting hunt and admire each other's bravery, the women went to work. There was a stream close by, but enough of a distance from the canyon that it presented a minor inconvenience. Once they had the carcass divided into large haunches, they moved closer to the stream, leaving most of the bones with bits of meat still clinging to them to the prowling and flying scavengers, but little else. The clan used nearly every part of the animal. The tough mammoth hide could be made into foot coverings, sturdier and longer lasting than the skin of other animals, windbreaks for the mouth of the cave, cooking pots, sturdy thongs for lashings, outdoor shelters. The soft undercoat of downy hair could be beaten into a kind of felt material used for stuffing pillows or pallets for beds, even as absorbent filling for babies' swaddling. The long hair was twisted into sturdy cord, the tendons into strands of sinew. Bladders, stomach, intestines could be used as water containers, soup pots, food storage, even waterproof rainwear. Little was wasted. Not only were meat and other parts used, the fat was particularly essential. It made up the balance of necessary calories to fuel their energy requirements, which included metabolic warmth in winter, as well as vigorous activity during warmer seasons. It was used as a dressing to cure hides, since many of the animals they killed, deer, horses, range-grazing aurochs and bison, rabbits and birds, were essentially lean. It supplied fuel for stone lamps that added an element of warmth as well as light. It was used for waterproofing and as a medium for salves, unguents, and emollients. It could be used to help start fires in wet wood, for long-burning torches, even as fuel to cook with in the absence of other fuels. The uses for fat were many. Every day, while the women worked, they watched the sky. If the weather was clear, the meat would dry in about 7 days, aided by the winds, which blew continually. There was no need for smoky fires. It was too cold for blowflies to spoil the meat. And it was just as well. Fuel was far more scarce on the steppes than on the wooded hillsides of their cave, or even the warmer southern steppes, which supported more trees. With intermittent clouds, overcast sky, or precipitation, it might take up to 3 times as long for the thin strips of meat to dry. The light powdery snow, whipped about by the gusting winds, was not a major problem. Only if the weather turned unseasonably warm and wet would the work be halted. They hoped for dry, clear, cold weather. The only way the mountains of flesh could be hauled back to the cave was if it was dried before they left. The heavy, shaggy skin, with its thick layer of fat and connective blood vessels, nerves, and follicles, was scraped clean. Thick slabs of the cold, hardened fat were placed in a large skin pot set over a fire, and the rendered fat poured into sections of the cleaned intestines and tied off like large, fat sausages. The hide, with the hair left on, was cut into manageable sections and tightly rolled, then allowed to freeze hard for the return trip. Later in the winter, back at the cave, it would be dehaired and cured. The tusks were broken off and proudly displayed at the campsite. They, too, would be carried back. During the days, while the women worked, the men hunted smaller game or kept watch in a desultory fashion. Moving closer to the stream had eliminated one inconvenience, but there was another, harder to remedy. The scavengers, drawn to the fresh kill, followed the hunting party to their new location. The strips of meat draped over lines of cords and thongs had to be constantly watched. One huge spotted hyena was more than persistent. It had been driven off many times, but it continued to lurk on the fringes of the camp, eluding the half-hearted efforts of the men to kill it. The fierce-looking creature was just crafty enough to snatch a mouthful of drying mammoth meat several times a day. It was a nuisance. Abra and Olga were hurrying to finish slicing the last of the huge chunks of meat into thin strips to start them drying. Uka and Ovra were pouring fat into a section of intestine, and Ayla was at the stream, flushing out another section. A crust of ice had formed at the edges, but the water was still flowing. The men were standing near the tusks, trying to decide if they wanted to hunt jerboas with their slings.
Brock had been sitting near his mother and Abra, playing with pebbles. He became bored with the stones and got up to find something more interesting to do. The women were concentrating on their task and didn't notice him wandering off toward the open plains. But another pair of eyes watched him. Every head in the camp turned at the sound of his terrified, high-pitched scream.
"My baby!"
Olga cried.
"The hyena has my baby!"
The loathsome scavenger, which was also a predator and always ready to attack the unwary, young, or enfeebled old, had seized the child by his arm with powerful jaws and was quickly retreating, dragging the small boy with him.
"Brock! Brock!"
Broud was shouting as he ran after them, followed by the rest of the men. He reached for his sling. He was too far away for a spear and stooped to pick up a stone, hurrying before the beast got out of his range.
"No! Oh, no!"
he cried in despair as the stone fell short and the hyena kept going.
"Brock! Brock!"
Suddenly, from another direction came the thwack-thwack of two stones fired in quick succession. They landed squarely on the animal's head, and the hyena dropped in his tracks. Proud stood in open-mouthed amazement that turned to stunned astonishment when he saw Ayla running toward the wailing child with her sling still in her hand and two more stones held ready. The hyena was her prey. She had studied these animals, knew their habits and their weak spots, trained herself until hunting such quarry was second nature. When she heard Brock scream, she didn't think of the consequences. She just reached for her sling, quickly grabbed two pebbles, and hurled them. Her only thought was to stop the hyena that was dragging Brock away. It was only after she reached the child, extracted him from the dead hyena's grip, and turned to face the staring eyes of the others that the full impact hit her. Her secret was out. She had given herself away. They knew she could hunt. A wave of cold fear washed over her. "What will they do to me?" she thought. Ayla cuddled the baby, avoiding the unbelieving stares, as she walked back to the campsite. Olga came out of her shock first. She ran toward them, holding out her arms, and gratefully accepted her baby boy from the girl who had saved his life. As soon as they reached the camp, Ayla began examining the child, as much to keep from looking at anyone else as to determine the extent of his injuries. Brock's arm and shoulder were mangled, and his upper arm bone was broken, but it looked like a clean break. She had never set an arm, but she had watched Isa do it, and the medicine woman had talked to her about what to do if an emergency came up. Issa's concern had been for the hunters. It didn't occur to her that something might happen to the baby. Ayla stirred up the fire, started water boiling, and got her medicine bag. The men were silent, still stunned, not quite able or willing to accept what they had just seen. For the first time in his life, Braud felt grateful to Ayla. His thoughts didn't go much beyond relief that the son of his mate had been saved from a certain and ugly death. But Brun's did. The leader was quick to grasp the implications and knew he was suddenly faced with an impossible decision. By clan tradition, in effect clan law, the punishment for any woman who used a weapon was no less than death. It was clear-cut. There were no provisions for unusual circumstances. The custom was so ancient and so well understood, it hadn't even been invoked for generations beyond count. The legends surrounding it were closely linked with the legends about a time when women controlled the access to the world of the spirits before the men took them over. That custom was one of the forces that had caused the marked differentiation between clan men and clan women, since no woman with an unfeminine desire to hunt was allowed to survive. Over countless ages, only those with properly female attitudes and actions were left. As a result, the adaptability of the race, the very trait upon which survival depends, was curtailed. But it was the clan way, clan law, even though there were no longer deviant clan women. But Ayla was not born to the clan. Brun loved the son of Braud's mate. Only with Brock did the leader's stoic reserve soften. The baby could do anything to him, pull his beard, poke curious fingers in his eyes, spit up all over him. It didn't matter. Brun was never so gentle, so pliable, as when the small boy fell asleep with the peaceful assurance of security in the proud and stiff leader's arms. He had no doubt Brock would not be alive if Ayla had not killed the hyena. How could he condemn to death the girl who had saved Brock's life? She had saved him with the weapon she must die for using. How had she done it, he wondered. The beast was out of range, and she was farther away from it than the men. Brun walked over to where the slain hyena still lay
and touched the drying blood that oozed from the fatal wounds. Wounds? Two wounds? His eyes hadn't been deceived. He thought he had seen two stones. How had the girl learned to use a sling with such skill? Not Zaug or anyone he ever heard of could fire two stones from a sling so rapidly, so accurately, and with such force. Force enough to kill a hyena from that distance. No one ever used a sling to kill a hyena anyway. He had been sure from the start that Braud's attempt would be a futile gesture. Zaug always said it could be done, but privately, Brunn wasn't sure. He had never contradicted the man. Zaug was still too valuable an asset to the clan. There was no point in belittling him. Well, Zaug had been proved right. Could a sling be used to kill a wolf or a lynx, too, as Zaug so stoutly maintained, Brunn mused. Suddenly his eyes opened wide, then narrowed. A wolf or a lynx? Or a wolverine, or wildcat, or badger, or ferret, or a hyena, Brunn's mind raced. Or all the other predators that have been found dead lately. Of course, Brunn's motion emphasized his thought. She did it. Ayla's been hunting for a long time. How else could she have gained such skill? But she's female. She learned the women's skills easily. How could she learn to hunt? And why predators? And why such dangerous ones? And why at all? If she were a man, she'd be the envy of every hunter. But she's not a man. Ayla is female, and she used a weapon, and she must die for it, or the spirits will be very angry. Angry? She's been hunting for a long time. Why aren't they angry? They're anything but angry. We just killed a mammoth in a hunt so lucky not one man was even injured. The spirits are pleased with us, not angry. The confused leader shook his head. Spirits. I don't understand spirits. I wish Mogur were here. Droog says she carries luck. I half think he's right. Things have never gone so well since we found her. If they favor her so much, would it make them unhappy if she was killed? But it's the clan way, he agonized. Why did she have to be found by my clan? She may be lucky, but she's given me more headaches than I ever thought possible. I can't make a decision without talking to Mogur. I'll just have to let it wait until we get back to the cave. Brunn strode back to the camp. Ayla had given the boy painkilling medicine that put him to sleep, then cleaned his wounds with an antiseptic solution, set the arm, and put on a cast of dampened birch bark. It would dry stiff and hard and hold the bones in place. She'd have to watch it, though, in case it swelled too much. She watched Brunn coming back from examining the hyena and trembled as he approached. But he walked past her without a sign, ignoring her completely. And she realized she would not learn her fate until they got back to the cave. Chapter 15. The seasons changed in reverse as the hunting party traveled south from winter to fall. Threatening clouds and the smell of snow hurried their departure. They had no desire to be caught by the first real blizzard of the peninsula's northern winter. The warmer weather at the southern end gave a false feeling of approaching spring, with an unsettling twist. Rather than new shoots and budding wildflowers, tall grass swayed in golden waves on the steppes, and the bloom of the temperate trees at the protected tip was in shades of crimson and amber, patchworked with evergreen. But the view from the distance was deceiving. Most deciduous trees had dropped their leaves, and the onslaught of winter was close behind. It took longer to return than to reach the site of the mammoth herd. The fast, distance-devouring pace was impossible with their heavy loads. But Ayla was weighed down with more than mammoth. Guilt, anxiety, and depression were far heavier burdens. No one spoke of the incident, but it wasn't forgotten. Often her casual glance caught someone staring at her before they turned aside, quickly, and few spoke to her unless it was necessary. She felt isolated, lonely, and more than a little frightened. As little conversation as she had, it was enough for her to learn the penalty for her crime. The people left behind at the cave had been watching for the return of the hunters. From the time of their earliest expected arrival, someone was posted near the ridge where there was a good view of the steppes, most often one of the children. When Vorn first took his turn early in the day, he stared out at the distant panorama conscientiously, but then he got bored. He didn't like being off by himself without even Borg to play with. He devised imaginary hunts and jabbed his not-quite-full-sized spear into the ground so often
that the point became frayed despite fire hardening. It was only by accident that he happened to glance down the hill as the hunting party came into view.
Tusks! Tusks!
Vorn shouted, racing back to the cave. Tusks? Aga asked. What do you mean, tusks?
They're back, Vorn gesticulated excitedly. Brun and Drug and the rest, and I saw them carrying tusks.
Everyone ran halfway to the steps to greet the victorious hunters, but when they reached them, it was apparent something was wrong. The hunt was successful. The hunters should have been jubilant. Instead, their step was heavy and their manner subdued. Brun was grim, and Issa needed only one look at Ayla to know something terrible had happened that involved her daughter. While the hunting party unloaded some of their burden on those who had remained behind, the reason for the somber silence unfolded. Ayla trudged up the slope with bowed head, oblivious to the surreptitious glances cast in her direction. Issa was dumbfounded. If she had ever worried over the unorthodox actions of her adopted daughter before, it was nothing to the icy shaft of fear she felt for her now. When they reached the cave, Olga and Abra brought the child to Issa. She cut away the birch bark cast and examined the boy. His arms should be as good as new before long, she pronounced. He'll be scarred, but the wounds are healing, and the arm is set well. I'd better put another cast on it, though. The women breathed easier. They knew Ayla was inexperienced, and though they had little choice but to allow the girl to treat Brock, they were concerned. A hunter needed two good, strong arms. If Brock lost the use of one, he would never become a leader as he was destined. If he was unable to hunt, he would not even become a man, but would live out his life in the ambiguous limbo in which older boys, who had reached physical maturity but had not made their first kill, existed. Brun and Braud were relieved, too. But for Brun, at least, the news was received with mixed emotions. It made his decision more difficult. Ayla had not only saved Brock's life, she had assured his useful existence. The matter had been put off long enough. He signaled Mogur, and they walked off together. The story, as Brun explained it, left Kreb deeply troubled. Ayla was his responsibility to raise and train, and he had obviously failed. But there was something else that troubled him even more. When he first learned of the animals the men kept finding, he felt it had nothing to do with spirits. He even wondered if Zaug or one of the other men was playing some kind of elaborate joke on the rest. It seemed unlikely, but his intuition told him the deaths were caused by a human agent. He had also been aware of changes in Ayla, changes he should have recognized now that he thought about it. Women did not walk with the quiet stealth of a hunter. They made noise, and with good reason. More than once, Ayla had startled him by approaching so silently he didn't hear her coming. There were other things, too, small things that should have made him suspicious. But he was blinded by his love for her. He didn't allow himself to imagine she could be hunting. He was far too aware of the consequences. It caused the old magician to question his own integrity, his ability to perform his function. He had let his feeling for the girl come before the spiritual safekeeping of the clan. Did he still merit their trust? Was he still worthy of Ursus? Could he still justifiably continue as Mogur? Kreb took the blame for her actions on himself. He should have questioned her. He should not have let her roam so freely. He should have disciplined her more severely. But all his anguish over what he should have done didn't change in the least what he still had to do. The decision was Brun's, but it was his function to carry it out, his duty to kill the child he loved.
"It's only a guess that she's the one who has been killing the animals," Brun said. "We need to question her, but she did kill the hyena, and she had a sling. She had to practice on something. There's no other way she could have gained such skill. She's better than Zaug with that weapon, Mogur, and she's female. How did she ever learn? I've wondered before if there isn't some male in her, and I'm not the only one. She's as tall as a man and not even a woman yet. Do you think there's any truth in the idea that she may never become one?"
"Ayla's a girl, Brun, and someday she'll become a woman just like any other girl. Or she would have. She is a female who used a weapon." The magician's jaw was set. He would not allow himself to grasp at false illusions.
"Well, I still want to know how long she's been hunting. But it can wait until morning. We're all tired now. It was a long journey. Tell Ayla we'll question her tomorrow."
Kreb limped back to the cave,
but stopped at his hearth only long enough to signal Issa to tell the girl she would be questioned in the morning, before continuing on to his small annex. He did not return to his hearth all night. The women stared silently after the men who were walking into the woods with Ayla trailing behind. They were at a loss, filled with mixed emotions. Ayla was confused herself. She had always known it was wrong to hunt, if not how serious the crime was.
I wonder if it would have made any difference if I had known, she asked herself.
No, I wanted to hunt. I would have hunted anyway. But I don't want the evil ones to chase me all the way to the spirit world. She shuddered at the thought. The girl feared the invisible, malign entities as much as she believed in the power of protective totems. Not even the spirit of the cave lion could protect her from them.
Could he?
I must have been wrong, she thought. My totem wouldn't have given me a sign to let me hunt, knowing I'd die for it. He probably left me the first time I picked up a sling. She didn't like thinking about it. The men came to a clearing and arranged themselves on logs and boulders on either side of Brunn, while Ayla slumped to the ground at his feet. Brunn tapped her shoulder to allow her to look up at him and began without preliminaries.
Were you the one who killed the meat-eaters the hunters kept finding, Ayla?
Yes, she nodded. There was no point in trying to hide anything now. Her secret was out, and they would have known if she tried to evade their questions. She could no more lie than any other member of the clan could.
How did you learn to use a sling?
I learned from Zaug, she replied.
Zaug?
Brunn echoed. All heads turned accusingly toward the old man.
I never taught the girl to use a sling, he gestured defensively.
Zaug didn't know I was learning from him, Ayla motioned quickly, springing to the old sling hunter's defense. I watched him when he was teaching Vorn.
How long have you been hunting? Brunn asked next.
2 summers now, and the summer before that I just practiced, but I didn't hunt.
That's as long as Vorn has been training, Zaug commented.
I know, Ayla said. I started the same day he did.
How do you know exactly when Vorn started, Ayla?
Brunn asked, curious how she could be so sure. I was there. I watched him.
What do you mean you were there? Where?
At the practice field. Issa sent me to get some wild cherry bark, but when I got there, you were all there, she explained. Issa needed the cherry bark, and I didn't know how long you were going to stay, so I waited and watched. Zaug was giving Vorn his first lesson.
You watched Zaug give Vorn his first lesson? Braud cut in. Are you sure it was his first?
Braud remembered that day only too well.
It still brought a blush of shame to his face.
Yes, Braud, I'm sure, she replied.
What else did you see?
Braud's eyes were narrowed and his gestures clipped.
Brunn, too, suddenly remembered what had happened in the practice field the day Zaug began Vorn's training, and he wasn't happy at the thought of a female witnessing the incident.
Ayla hesitated. I saw the other men practicing, too, she answered, trying to evade the issue.
Then she saw Brunn's eyes become stern.
And I saw Braud push Zaug down, and you got very mad at him, Brunn.
You saw that? You saw the whole thing?
Braud demanded. He was livid with anger and embarrassment. Of all people, of all the people in the clan, why was she the one who had to see it? The more he thought about it, the more mortified he became, and the more furious. She was witness to Brunn's harshest denunciation of him.
Braud even remembered how badly he missed his shots, and suddenly recalled that he had missed the hyena, too. The hyena she killed, a female, that female, had shown him up. Every kind thought, every bit of gratitude he had so recently felt toward her vanished. I'll be so glad when she's dead, he thought. She deserves it. He couldn't bear the idea of her continuing to live with her knowledge of his supreme moment of shame.
Brunn watched the son of his mate and could almost read his thoughts from the expressions on his face. Too bad, he thought, just when there was some chance of ending the animosity between them. Not that it matters any more. He continued the questioning.
You said you began to practice the same day as Vorn. Tell me about it.
After you left, I walked across the field and saw the sling Braud threw on the ground. Everyone forgot about it after you got mad at Braud. I don't know why, but I just wondered if I could do it. I remembered Zaug's lesson and tried. It wasn't easy, but I kept trying all afternoon. I forgot how late it was getting. I hit the post once. I think it was just an accident, but it made me think I could do it again if I worked at it, so I kept the sling.
I suppose you learned how to make one from Zaug, too.
Yes.
And you practiced that summer?
Yes.
Then you decided to hunt with it. But why did you hunt meat-eaters? They're more difficult, more dangerous, too. We've found dead wolves, even dead lynxes. Zaug always said they could be killed with a sling. You proved he was right. But why those?
I knew I could never bring anything back for the clan. I knew I wasn't supposed to touch a weapon. But I wanted to hunt. I wanted to try, anyway. Meat-eaters are always stealing food from us. I thought if I killed them, I would be helping. And it wouldn't be such a waste. We don't eat them. So I decided to hunt them.
It satisfied Brun's curiosity about why she chose predators, but not why she wanted to hunt in the first place. She was female. No woman ever wanted to hunt. You know it was dangerous to try for the hyena from so far away. You might have hit Brock instead.
Brun was probing. He had been ready to try his bola, though the chances of killing the boy with one of the large stones was more than a possibility. But instant death from a cracked skull was preferable to the one the child faced, and at least they would have had the boy's body to bury, so he could be sent on his way to the spirit world with proper rituals. They would have been lucky to find scattered bones if the hyena had had his way.
I knew I could hit it, Ayla answered simply. How could you be sure? The hyena was out of range.
He wasn't out of my range. I've hit animals before from that distance. I don't miss often.
I thought I saw the marks of two stones, Brun motioned.
I threw two stones, Ayla confirmed. I taught myself after the lynx attacked me.
You were attacked by a lynx? Brun pressed.
Yes, Ayla nodded, and told of her close call with the large cat.
What is your range? Brun asked. No, don't tell me. Show me. Do you have your sling?
Ayla nodded and got up. They all moved to the far end of the clearing where a small brook trickled over a rocky bed. She selected a few pebbles of the right size and shape. Round ones were best for accuracy and distance, but jagged, sharp-edged broken pieces would work. The small white rock beside the large boulder at the other end, she motioned.
Brun nodded. It was easily half again as far as any of them could hurl a stone.
She sighted carefully, inserted a stone in her sling, and had a second one in the sling and on its way the next instant.
Zaug jogged over to confirm her accuracy. There are two fresh chips knocked out of the white stone. She hit the mark both times, he announced on his return, with a trace of wonder and the barest hint of pride.
She was female. She should never have touched the sling. Clan tradition was absolutely clear on that. But she was good. She gave him credit for teaching her, whether he knew it or not. That double stone technique, he thought, that's a trick I'd like to learn.
Zaug's pride was the pride of a true teacher for a pupil who excelled, a student who paid attention, learned well, and then did the master one better. And she had proved him right.
Brun's eye caught a movement in the clearing.
Ayla, he cried. That rabbit! Get him!
She glanced in the direction he was pointing, saw the small animal bounding across the field, and dropped him.
There was no need to check her accuracy.
Brun looked at the girl appreciatively. She's quick, he thought.
The idea of a woman hunting offended the leader's sense of propriety, but with Brun, the clan always came first. Their safety, their security, their prosperity were foremost. In a corner of his mind, he knew what an asset she could be to the clan. No, it's impossible, he said to himself. It's against the traditions. It's not the clan way. Kreb didn't have the same appreciation for her skill. If he had any doubts left, her exhibition convinced him. Ayla had been hunting.
Why did you ever pick up a sling in the first place?
Mogur gestured with a bleak, dark look.
I don't know. She shook her head and looked down.
More than anything, she hated the thought of the magician's displeasure.
You did more than touch it. You hunted with it, killed with it, when you knew it was wrong.
My totem gave me a sign, Kreb. At least, I thought it was a sign.
She was undoing the knots in her amulet.
After I decided to hunt, I found this.
She handed the fossil cast to Mogur. A sign? Her totem gave her a sign? There was consternation among the men. Ayla's revelation put a new twist on the situation. But why did she decide to hunt? The magician examined it closely. It was a very unusual stone, shaped like a sea animal, but definitely a stone. It could have been a sign, but that didn't prove anything. Signs were between a person and his totem. No one could understand another person's signs.
Mogur gave it back to the girl.
Kreb, she said pleadingly, I thought my totem was testing me. I thought the way Braud treated me was the test. I thought if I could learn to accept it, my totem would let me hunt.
Quizzical glances were cast in the young man's direction to see his reaction. Did she